Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host and DM, co-DM, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-DM,
McGill.
Really, I'm not the host or the DM, I'm the co-host and co-DM, just like McGill is. We're both co-hosts and co-DMs. And we talk about role-playing games. We talk about not just role-playing games. We don't just tell you about the role-playing games we're running. We're talking about the role-playing games we used to run. All the games that we've run in the past and what we've learned from them. And we try to learn from each other's stories. Maybe you'll learn a thing or two as well. It is the 28th of September, 2021. And to my knowledge, it is episode 81. We are recording literally the day after episode 80, but I've talked enough about on the podcast of my own desire to build that backlog up again. So if you've been listening, you know what's going on.
Time moves differently for us than for the listeners.
It kind of feels that way for role-playing games, you know? We were talking about the last episode about how you get frozen in stasis when your players are not moving forward the time of your game that you're in. And in that sense, you know, it's like Hannibal Buress has a bit about how he doesn't like when people say, "I'm just taking it one day at a time," because that's how time works. All of us are taking it one day at a time. He defies someone to tell them that they're taking life a week at a time, because he would love to get through this shit as quickly as them. But then it's funny because I feel like I take life a week at a time, because typically I'm running one session of my main game every week. And really, in that sense, time is only moving once per week. Do you know what I mean?
I was about to say that I felt like since the pandemic started, I've been kind of living life a week at a time, because, you know, I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, but I know people were definitely talking about it, like, just in general, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, how time started acting weird as we were all stuck at home and doing kind of the same routines in the same places over and over. And, you know, the human brain cuts out uninteresting or redundant information to just sort of save us the concentration. So, like, if every day is kind of the same, the days just drift by really quickly. And certainly in those early months of the pandemic, especially, I felt like I was living life a week at a time. I'd turn around and, you know, I thought it was Monday, but now it's Saturday, that kind of thing.
I have a very unrelated shout out that I wanted to give. I wasn't sure how relevant it would be, but I thought, no, you know what? I like it, so I'm going to give a shout out. Your thing about how people just doing the same thing over and over again. There's a great show that only got one season that I loved. It's from one of the creators of that show I love, Banshee, the show Quarry, which is about a guy who comes back from Vietnam and basically, through the shittiness of his situation, ends up having his only real out is to join a ring of hitmen that spans the Mississippi. And it's set in that post-Vietnam era, and it's a very, very good show. But there is a discussion between two of the hitmen early on in the show, where one of them is training the new guy and explains the process of observing the behavioral patterns of a target. And the new guy sort of scoffs and says, "What, because everybody does the same thing day in, day out?" And the other hitman says, "Are you kidding? Have you watched people? I wish the unexamined life weren't worth living, or else some of these fuckers might off themselves and do our job for us."
Yeah.
I like that assassin show. Everybody should watch that good assassin show, even though it only got one season.
Quarry, huh?
Quarry. Quarry, like in stone.
I still gotta watch Banshee, honestly.
Banshee's something else.
You wanted to do like a watch a Banshee watch through podcast for a while there. I think then we pivoted into this instead.
I mean, this is definitely the more this has more substance in the sort of overpopulated podcast ecosystem that already exists as it is. But Banshee's a great show. I mean, it's complicated. It's a great show, but there's a lot to be said about it, I think, particularly with some of the political developments of the time since the show has come out.
Interesting.
Well, the thing is that it's a show, first of all, it's about a criminal, it's about a career criminal who is posing as a sheriff. And so a lot of it deals with like small town police procedure, but then the guy who is in charge of the police is not a police officer, he's a criminal. And there is almost something very prescient about what you can draw from that narrative, basically, given how opinions of the police have developed in the past few years following the end of the show. And it's also a show where, because of it's a show that's like, it's like it was written by someone who runs role-playing games, because it's a small town setting, and yet there are like clear factions all over the place. There's a nearby military base, and so there's like the local army guys are sort of a faction, but then there's also a neighboring Amish community that's like really has always been part of the town, and so that's another sort of faction. And like there's this prodigal son of the Amish community, Kai Proctor, who's now the biggest gangster in Banshee and runs the criminal underground, and so he's got his whole faction. And then there's tension because historically there has always been territorial tension between the local Amish community and the Native American community that lives in the reserve adjacent to Banshee as well. And that in and of itself, having Native American issues and the issue of this reservation, like some of the small details that they focus in on for that element of the setting, again, feel just very ahead of its time, considering what had transpired in the years following the end of the show. Like, I don't think anybody would create a show like Banshee with the things that were in Banshee as cavalierly as they did when Banshee was made. Because I think a lot of the subjects that it dealt with have become a lot touchier in the past 5 years.
Interesting. You know, honestly, I'm kind of surprised you've never run a campaign based on Banshee, given your love for it.
So it'd be very hard for me. I mean, we've already talked about, first of all, like, even when we run published material, we put our own spin on it. Like, I tend to chafe against the restrictions of a setting at the best of times, and having a really established setting like Banshee, while it's a cool idea, it's probably, first of all, if I was going to use Banshee, thinking of it now, I would say that immediately my thought would be run it as a World of Darkness setting. Is like, do Banshee, but run like World of Darkness, maybe Vampire or something. That was one thing that was actually always kind of good about Banshee, is that they managed to make this really over-the-top action show without any supernatural elements. So it would actually maybe be the most appropriate thing for Banshee to just run base New World of Darkness and never move it into one of the supernatural settings, but just keep it at like the sort of dark modern setting that it was. But even then, it would be tough for me because Banshee is so much about the characters in Banshee. And it should be said, every one of them has a name that is so cartoonishly pulpy and appropriate to the setting that, like, you'd really miss their presence. If the bartender isn't an ex-prize fighter convict named Sugar Bates, and if the crime boss isn't a formerly Amish, ruthless criminal named Kai Proctor, and if the sheriff isn't secretly a criminal posing as a sheriff by the name of Lucas Hood, et cetera, et cetera, then what is it? What is Banshee at that point?
You know what it all, you say World of Darkness, but you know what it actually sounds like to me? It sounds like a Fiasco set.
It does. It is very, you know, the only thing that makes it more World of Darkness than Fiasco is the fact that, like, it's the thing that I always pitch Banshee as is it's a show about a small town where every citizen has advanced combat training. Like, there is a level of competency that prevents it from being a fiasco, because, like, in Fiasco, you just fuck up and things get out of your control. But in Banshee, things will get out of control, but you'll just have to fight a bunch of crazy badasses to get through it.
Hey, look at that. We're doing our Banshee podcast after all.
Well, it's just been 10 minutes of the episode so far, and maybe it's time we got on off of this. You know, like, we only started about Banshee because I wanted to shout out Quarry, which is such an underrated thing. But I love that little, I love the little moments that we have with the assassins just chatting it up in Quarry. It's great. So it's, as I mentioned, episode 81, and for episode 81, I have brought Operation Nine Creeks, as opposed to previous episode, which was Operation Nine Paths. Meanwhile, so I'm going to be kicking us off with that, and my Operation Nine Creeks is not super long, but I'm telling you, it's a good one. So I'm going to be kicking us off with that, but in the meantime, do you want to preview what you got for us, McGill?
The players in the Destiny of Istus campaign are continuing their descent to the deep levels of the mega dungeon beneath the ruins of Castle Greyhawk, and they're finally going to arrive on the same level where they can find the god trap. But there are a few obstacles in their way before they get there, so they probably won't be activating it this time, but next episode for sure.
The god trap awaits.
Sure does.
Well, I guess let's get rolling with it, because I got Operation Nine Creeks. So this one is based on, again, it's a module that is, it's a good module. The only reason that I would be hesitant to use it in, like so for example, when I made Ashes Against the Grain, the little mini campaign for us, I just picked six of these modules and said that each of those modules would be a part of the campaign. And I considered this one, but I wrote it off because this one almost, I think it's really well set up to be like a big, to establish something that will be big in your ongoing campaign. It's a simple module, but it introduces something at the core of it, which I'm sure you could replace with something more relevant to your module. But it introduces something that I think has such potential for an ongoing campaign element that, like, almost my primary impulse with this module would be, like, use it as the start to a campaign and see where things go from there. You'll understand why in time. But the module is DDEX211, so the 11th episode of the second season of the Adventurers League Dungeons and Dragons Expeditions, Oubliette of Fort Iron. So, Al's aces are briefed over a meal of bread, wine, and cheese. A potential Underdark hideout has been discovered, and it's possibly in use by the Cult of Krynax, but it could even be in use by the Knights at Eclipse themselves. Whatever the case, there's trouble all through the mountains, and they gotta crack down on the bad guys in their hideouts, and so they gotta check this one out. So they get to gain what information they can before the expedition. The party manages to learn the hideout is an old abandoned Dwerger fortress mine. It's a mine with a fortress built around it, or was. It's long abandoned, long ruined. Rumors of both hidden gold and hauntings surround the location. It's been abandoned for years. Before they head out, the party is equipped with substantial amount of mundane equipment like that is appropriate to their scenario with the mine and everything. So they leave with a dungeoneer's kit with the water skins filled with wine. They got a vial of holy water. They grab healing potions. They get rope. They got shovels and picks. Everything you need to descend into an old abandoned mine and see what's what. So they descend into the caverns of the old mine, and they're surprised when they discover the soil within. They find remarkably fertile soil in this old abandoned mine. This is not a normal feature.
Remarkably fertile. I sense mushrooms? Mushrooms coming?
Some sort of rich soil. I mean, if it's a dead-ass old abandoned mine, it's probably, you know, normally you don't find rich soil down there. But it could be mushrooms, maybe. Maybe it's mushrooms. Keep an eye out for the mushrooms as you explore. So they descend into a pit of this rich soil, and they trigger a quake. And the quake, oh man, it's a quake in the mine, and all of a sudden they're trapped in the mine. Classic. You know how it does. Man. Have I ever referenced Balto on this podcast before?
Like the animated movie Balto?
Yes.
I don't think so.
Man, I'm definitely going to have to reference at some point, because I keep mentioning ice caverns and something, and literally, like, all I think about during this is the ice cavern in Balto, which is like a standout scene. We should really include it on the show notes. Other things about Balto, well, the main thing you need to know about Balto, you've seen it, right?
No, I haven't. Well, okay. Actually, maybe I have. I think I know this. It's like a sled dog movie.
I mean, I'll also say, like, this is for the listeners as well, like, because more than the fact that it is an animated movie, it is a true story.
Is this the Iditarod one, or is this the one where he's like bringing vaccines or something?
It is a thing where he's bringing medicine, but it's a story of a hero dog that is driving a sled of critical medicine to Nome, Alaska, through the frigid wilderness, and despite the apparent like complete bodily failure of the human to deliver the medicine, the dog pulled through. And so the cartoon is from the perspective of the dog, voiced by Kevin Bacon, and he's a hero dog. He was born part wolf. He's a stray dog, and none of the other dogs give him any respect. And there's even a mean dog that tries to sabotage him out in the wilderness. But yeah,
so I just looked this up, and I think it's pretty funny because, as you said, you know, based on a true story. But it has two sequels, which I'm guessing are not based on.
Yeah, I don't think those are based on a true story.
Balto 2 Wolf Quest and Balto 3 Wings of Change.
Yeah, it sounds like I would bet that Wolf Quest is about him going to find his secret origin, because there's a whole thing where like he almost dies, but then he sees the vision of a wolf in the snow, and he like gets up again. It's very like mystical. And then Winds of Change is probably one that the Canadian government funded, that probably has a lot of like positive message about you know, the reality of the Canadian territories.
Probably. The description mainly says that now the dogs are being made obsolete because medicine is being delivered by planes.
Oh, shit. There you go.
Oh, shit! Look out, Balto!
Well, here's the real thing that you need to know about Balto. And it's too bad you haven't seen this, because this is so funny when you like know what it means.
Should I watch this? Is this like, this is worth watching? I take it. Hey, it's produced by Steven Spielberg.
Like, yeah, it's an all right, like animated kids movie. Here's the thing is that, so Balto, you know, you have some like comic relief characters. And so Balto has a friend who is like a goose who is Russian named Boris. I guess he's like a goose that migrated across the ice bridge or something. But whatever the case, Balto is friends with a goose name or like a duck or some kind of bird named Boris. And then they also have these friends, these two polar bears that are very cute and fluffy, and only one of them can really speak. One of them just goes like, and the other one speaks in like a fairly well-defined British accent. And those polar bears are named Muck and Luck, and their tragedy is they are polar bears that cannot swim. The quote is, "Shame of the polar bear who cannot swim. Woe is us." Fuck, I wish I could remember it. Whatever the case, Muck and Luck, the comedic relief polar bears, one of whom has a British accent, one of whom just speaks gibberish and who cannot swim and are just big, fluffy balls of white fur. They're voiced by Phil Collins. Both of them. And Phil Collins provides no music for the film.
Wow, that's surprising.
It is. Honestly, it's the sort of thing, it's like, you think back on the movie, it's like, oh yeah, that dog movie with Kevin Bacon. And then you find out that Phil Collins was in it, but he didn't provide any music. He just was two goofy little polar bears that were very funny.
Not to dive too deep into Balto, but here's an interesting thought. I see that Balto was made in 1995, and it is produced by Steven Spielberg. Well, the year before, Spielberg directed the movie Hook, and Phil Collins is in that as a detective. And he also provides no music in that. Maybe the mid-90s was just the era of Phil Collins trying to act in Spielberg movies.
I'd give it to him for Muck and Luck. They were adorable. But the whole reason this comes up is because Balto, you know, if there's one scene worth watching on Balto that isn't any scene with Muck and Luck with them in YouTube, in YouTube, there's, I'm sure you can find like the ice cavern scene from Balto. We'll have to put it in the show notes, but that is like, to me, an iconic scene of like the dogs enter the cavern, and it's like a house of mirrors. Like the stalagmites and stalactites of ice as they pass by them are like warping their visages and everything. And they're like, oh, and then like it's like that classic sort of Mines of Moria thing where like one thing gets knocked over and all of a sudden, like all the stalactites start raining down like like knives of ice, and it's very well animated. And then from there, you've just got like a classic action sequence of like the dogs desperately racing through this like collapsing ice chamber, and like a huge shard of ice like chops into the sled that's carrying the medicine, and they lose some of the medicine and they have to pull it away, and like the whole time there's just icicles landing everywhere. It's a classic scene and something I always think of with like this sort of cavern cave-in kind of scenario, you know? That part at least is definitely worth a watch, because I think it's a phenomenal little animated sequence.
So let's see, what other B properties can we add to my watch list? I gotta watch Balto. I gotta watch Banshee.
Nirvana the band, the show. I mean, all
it has a B in it.
The thing about Nirvana the band, the show, is that every episode is named something that starts with B. It's the banner, the band, the book, the buffet, the birthday. Literally everyone is the B something. So anyways, I'm getting hung up on this. So they're trapped in the mine, and now they're traveling through the mine looking for an exit. But this is when they come to a realization. There's a strange sort of magic that is permeating the entire mine, and it's stable, but they begin to understand that the caverns that they're occupying seem to be alive. It's like they're in a living cavern. They encounter a group of strange animated stone elementals, which I called Wrath Rocks. So these sort of humanoid rock figures that attack them. But then from there, the party proceeds into the guts of the mine, and then into the belly, a massive bubbling acidic pit which spits acid at them as they fly over it.
Oh man, this is like an Empire Strikes Back situation, isn't it?
It 100% is. One advantage is, like, if you're running this at, like, the low level that it is regionally ascribed to, there's a lot of, like, difficulty climbing through. There's a whole thing of, like, sort of, you can, like, swing along the long, ropey stalactite of the uvula, and then you run into the Wrath Rocks that, like, I don't know what they're supposed to be, like, fucking kidney stones or something, whatever. But...
Oh, you know what it could be, actually? They're animals that swallow stones to help with digestion. So there
maybe.
You go.
So you fight those, and then you've got this huge pit of acid that you have to get across, probably by, like, swinging from stalactites or climbing or something, but, like, it's this bubbling pit of acid, the belly, and then you have to climb out. But the players, of course, had fly, as I mentioned a few times before in the podcast. And so they are sort of, once they sort of start figuring what's going on, once they see the belly of acid, they decide to fly over it. They ascend up through the throat, where they become aware of the breath and the heartbeat of the mine, at which point they come out and arrive in the mouth, and the party discovers the corpse of a purple worm lodged in its jagged teeth of stalagmites and stalactites. And so they try to scale the corpse of the worm as the teeth are gnashing to imperil them. As they're climbing the worm, they find an ornate old magical battle axe lodged in it that had been the original way that the beast had been killed. But unfortunately, they're climbing this corpse of the purple worm as these stalactites and stalagmites just crush in on them. And they find this magic axe that slayed the purple worm, but then the spirits of the dwerger that killed the purple worm are also guarding the axe. So the players are suddenly, they're having teeth crushing in on them, they're on the back of a purple worm, they're trying to stay balanced while the cave tries to crush them with its teeth, and then all these dwerger specters show up and start attacking them. So they have to fight these dwerger specters, in among the teeth. The specters don't have to worry about the teeth because they're incorporeal. And then finally, the players seize the Dwerger relic, the axe, and they clear the teeth, and they ascend up into the brain, a round cave of strange stone obelisks surrounding a mighty, radiant crystal brain. They seize this magical axe, they ascend up into the brain, this round cave of strange stone obelisks surrounding a mighty, radiant crystal brain. Within the brain chamber, this is where they meet their foes. They find a hostile acolyte accompanied by two Svirfneblin spies. Do you know what a Svirfneblin is?
Yeah, Svirfneblin is the Underdark version of a gnome.
Correct. And these little guys, I include them in the doodle, but I had them in little gas masks, basically. They look like little, creepy little masked goggle guys with a little rapier and
They're little TF2 pyros.
Yeah, kind of. But also, I don't know, they've got... looking at them now, maybe it's just like my frame of reference, but they've got kind of like a bondage look. I don't know. It's that tight black mask and the little ears poking up.
What is this, Ravenloft?
Creepy little bondage Svirfneblin. But then not just a hostile acolyte and two Svirfneblin spies, but they also have a trained attack bat cob, and they have some enthralled troglodytes, and there's a small swarm of sturges in the brain pan area. And the Svirfneblin have sturge bombs, which basically, if you get hit by one of these bombs, it's like it aggroes the sturge. It's like you've been hit with sturge pheromones or something, and suddenly that swarm of sturges is going to swarm you compulsively because you got hit by the Sturge Bomb. However, more dangerous than any of these foes is the Crystal Brain itself. Exposure to the brain risks stone madness. I actually have in the little doodles included the 1d6 roll for Stone Madness, which I believe was a wisdom save that you had to make anytime you were within 30 feet of the brain crystal. But then if you failed, you got a d6 roll. And examples include for if you roll a 1, just have to start hugging rocks. Just got to go either hug one of those stone obelisks or go hug the brain. If you roll a 2, you're overcome with a sense of doom, and you grant advantage to attack you. You get a 3, you get stone legs, your speed is reduced to 0. If you get 4, if you roll 4, you get Earth Scream. You start screaming uncontrollably, and suddenly you can't cast any verbal magic, and you cannot hide. But the person who succumbed to the stone madness most thoroughly in the end was Nessalie. Nessalie Goodberry. With little explanation of the party, once the enemies had been defeated, Nessalie laid claim to the crystal, claimed it was hers, and eventually would even have it sent back to her home plane of Thress. And as a little note, since Nessalie, unlike her predecessor Mealy, rarely asked for more than her fair share of treasure, the other party members, Ara Stormglass, Kendor, and Chessie Dildira, they just sort of shrugged it off. They were like, yeah, okay, you can have the crystal brain if you want it. I didn't actually include it in my notes here, but actually there's a funny reference that is, we're going to have to include another weird thing in the show notes. We're going to have to include a link to the video, This Is My Milwaukee, because I named the crystal brain the Godseed Fragment, which is a reference to the weird ARG, This Is My Milwaukee.
I thought you were about to say you named the brain Terry Nanny.
No. I named the brain the Godseed Fragment. in reference to such great lines from This Is My Milwaukee as thrown to the Godseed fragment.
Hamburgers.
Hamburger. I'll buy you a hamburger when I'm back from the tombs. But the Godseed fragment, which caused so much trouble for the people of Milwaukee, is now residing in Nestle's home plane of Thress, which is already quite deeply involved with Mephisto and a sort of cosmological trade with hell itself. So, you know, I'm sure Thress will be fine housing the Godseed fragment in addition to hosting a cavalcade of devils representing the interests of Mephisto.
Hamburgers.
So, those references are too much to even explain. We just have to put the video on the, you know, thing and hope that people watch it, because, you know, I can't make sense of it. Fucking vermouth. So that's Operation Nine Creeks.
In the belly of a beast.
Speaking of, beneath Castle Greyhawk.
In the belly of a metaphorical beast, I guess you could say.
In the belly of the whale. Starving in the belly of the whale.
So where we last left our players, they had taken a long rest to replenish their spells and heal up. In advance of descending into the next level of the dungeon, the mega dungeon. And so they do that, and then they use, you may recall that there was like a teleportation chamber on the level that they had arrived at. And so they use that, they use the teleporter and teleport to the level below.
That's dangerous shit, man. If they did that in Tomb of Horrors, there's a good chance they'd end up in a room with no clothes, and maybe their gender would be switched. And also, when they leave the room with their no clothes and no equipment, like four super-powered flying swords come out and just cut them to pieces.
Yeah, this is the thing, is like, I don't know. Maybe this is a good question. A good question.
Acerrac gives a bad name to dungeon teleportation arcs. I'll tell you that.
Well, maybe this is a good question for a fellow DM. But like when you're going all out, because this is all building towards the big final encounter for this campaign. They've just had sort of a penultimate final encounter where they faced off against two mini bosses. It would have been all too easy for me to just fully stack this whole thing with traps, you know, something as simple as like, well, we got to use the teleporter to get to the next level. But as you said, you know, maybe they teleport and they come out wrong. They come out inside out, or something about them has changed or whatever. How do you find the balance? Obviously, you can use a challenge rating calculator to sort of put together an encounter that way, but how do you find the balance? At what point do you go like, okay, this is too much, I gotta at least, you know, let them get to the next level unscathed?
I mean, I don't like to worry about the balance so much, so when I can, I just lean on a pre-written module, you know?
Yeah,
that's one of the advantages.
That is definitely what I was doing
so
here
far. it's just your players are lucky that the pre-written module wasn't Tomb of Horrors. But that said, I think that like when you are running Tomb of Horrors, you like make it clear to your players in some way.
Yeah.
They want to get to the end and then suddenly get screwed over by a teleporter arc. They would have like lost nine characters already in the process of this campaign having learned that lesson.
Yeah, I guess if you're running something like Return of the Tomb of Horrors, you gotta sort of preface the entire thing by saying, like, you guys might die. It's real mean.
I mean, if I ran Return to the Tomb of Horrors, I'd straight up tell people to roll multiple characters and, like, basically have that as their roster and be ready for some of them to be lost.
Yeah.
But I will also say that you mentioned like having big traps and stuff. So like, I think, for my own purposes, like the idea of having them go through the teleporter and they're just inside out, I wouldn't do that. But have them go through the teleporter and then suddenly they realize that they're in like the barracks of the enemy and there's like more hobgoblins to fight than they've ever seen. I might do that to them, because at that point, at least it's not just a trap that they fell for. It's just like, well, now since you're so high level, you're going to have to prove that you're badass enough to get out of a situation this bad.
I think that's a, yeah, that's a good way to do it.
Traps kind of like it's a bit more pass fail. Like it takes a bit of that agency away. Whereas like when I think of really high level dungeons that I've run, it's something where like, again, it's the same philosophy of like giving the player in a first person shooter a room full of health and ammo before they go into the boss fight. Is like, I generally make sure that the players are as fully prepared for a big, huge thing at the end as they can be. And then, you know, at that point, if they are having trouble, it's like, well, they just have to use their resources better. It's like, the balance comes from the fact that I've given them so many advantages that it should not, like, generally, it should not even be that hard for them. And when it does get hard, it should only be because like they need to just apply themselves more. Do you know what I mean?
This is exactly what I'm getting at. And I even have a ready example for this sort of thing.
I have a ready example, actually, that is something that I just recently ran.
You better take yours then, because my ready example is actually the first encounter that they are going to have when they get out of the teleporter.
So again, this is something that applies to my ongoing MPOC campaign. So theoretically, sometime in the future, I'm going to mention this, and this is going to sound familiar. But my players are level 20. They are in the third phase of a huge three-phase battle, which is like the big assault on the enemy capital in this setting. And So in this third phase, now that they're level 20 and it's like the peak of the battle, I'm like, okay, no punches are being held. There are blasts, like there are fire beams shooting down from this huge tower that if you fail your save, you take 8d20 fire damage. Like, and the fact is they should be carrying so many healing potions and potions of invulnerability and things that give them resistance against specific damage types, that they should be able to get hit by one of those and say, oh shit, well, I have a response for this, and then do it. Similarly, in that battle, I put them up against, basically they were sort of like moving around behind enemy lines, and I was like, okay, well, something bad's gonna be patrolling behind enemy lines for you guys. And they realized that it was two beholders, not one, but two. And so these two just balls of laser death come down at them, and they have legendary actions, and they have three shots per action. And the players are literally like, as soon as they're in this fight, they're just getting hit by beam after beam after beam, and they're losing so much health so quickly. But you know what the solution is?
A mirror.
It's not a bad one, but beholders, for their eye ray action and for their legendary action, which is just another eye ray, every attack specifies it is a target that the beholder can see. And the MPOC has smoke grenades, flashbangs, tear gas. So the realization was not that they just had to brute force fight these beholders, because these beholders had like twice as many attacks as the entire party per round. If they had just gone head to head with them, the party would have been wiped out. But when one of the party starts throwing out smoke grenades and catching these beholders in clouds of smoke that they can't see through, suddenly the beholders are doing, like, no damage. And that's the kind of situation where it's like, I put them in a situation that was seemed insurmountable. Like to an unequipped and unprepared party, that would have seemed completely unfair. But their inventory is full of things that they've gotten throughout the campaign. Like, even beyond the smoke grenades, one of the players has a gem of seeing. So they can smoke grenade themselves and then activate the gem of seeing and then have true sight that lets them see beyond the smoke, no problem.
Interesting.
So yeah, it's a situation where it's like they had the solution. It just wasn't as simple as their stats allowed them to be better than the enemy. It was they had built up their characters in a way that was not passive that allowed them to address this situation. And right. For the record, I'm still running that. They still haven't killed the second beholder. So, you know, jury's out.
The example I was going to give actually sort of touches more on a different part of what you were saying, which is the idea of, like, knowing that your players are about to go into a very big encounter and allowing them the opportunity to kind of buff up and get ready, similar to in a video game before a boss battle, you know, finding a room full of buffs and potions and items. And I guess I kind of gave it to them by presenting them with a place where they could take a long rest at the end of the last episode. But this one, when they arrive on this level, there are three sort of main encounters before they arrive at their destination. And those three encounters, they were the part that I was trying to sort of carefully balance so that they could be decent challenges, but I knew that once the players got through them, they probably wouldn't have another opportunity to, like, heal up or rest. So I wanted them to be challenging, but also lead into the big final encounter. And so I kind of rejiggered some of these encounters to make them, like, a little less deadly. And I think the perfect example of that is the very first one, which is they go through the teleporter and they arrive in this entrance chamber, and in the center of the entrance chamber is this 4-foot-high pyramid made of blue metal. Its surface crackles with energy, and it's a trap, and anybody, like any persona non gratis, who's not supposed to be on this level, who steps out of the teleporter, immediately this energy spewing pyramid trap starts firing off bolts of electricity at multiple targets, and in an attempt to sort of thwart any intruders. And
tell you what this reminds me of. First of all, it reminds me of the lightning rod in that other episode that I described recently. But also it reminds me, I was staring at the cover of Iron Maiden's Power Slave, which I think is my favorite Iron Maiden album. But it's got that pyramid, and up at the top, crackling blue energy pyramid.
Hey, I wonder if the authors of Expedition to the Ruins of Greyhawk were inspired by that.
I fucking bet they were. I bet they were drinking beer and smoking weed and listening to Iron Maiden. They were like, whoa, dude.
Hey, man, you know what would be pretty cool is we got one of these energy-spewing pyramid traps. But let me read off what...
I also just want to say that, like, I always associate D&D with more, like, you know, weed, beer, that sort of thing. But apparently Gary Gygax's drug of choice was cocaine.
Oh, wow.
by all accounts.
Well, I mean, I guess it did reach its popularity in the 80s, didn't it? So I'm going to read out what is written for this trap in the module, and you can see why I nerfed this one a bit. So this energy-spewing pyramid trap hits automatically and deals 10d6 electricity damage plus 10d6 fire damage with a reflex save, so a dexterity saving throw now, DC of 20 for half damage.
It's funny because that is like the sort of thing that I have my players going up against in the current situation in my game where they're level 20. But it's like, even when I write that out, it's like I do this little look on my face like, ugh. Like I do a little wince like, ugh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Are you sure?
I kept the reflex DC for half damage the same, but I halved all the other damage because it's like, I don't think, well, I guess a possible total of what, 120 HP? That might have taken somebody out. Can't remember offhand exactly how much HP everybody had, but that's a big hit. So I nerfed that one, and sure enough, like, the players come out of the teleporter, and as soon as they step into the room, bolts of electricity start flying around, they all take some damage, and just immediately flee into the next room over, which is a ziggurat. And,
we love ziggurats around here.
You gotta love them ziggurats. And in the ziggurat were two, what are they called? Hezrus. Or three, sorry, three Hezrus. Are you familiar with these guys?
Oh, yeah, big old, them's the stinky frog demons, yeah?
Yeah, big,
Hezrus.
Toad monsters that are crouched all over the various platforms of the ziggurat. And as soon as the players enter, they begin their attack. And the main thing, so I wanted to, as I said, there are these like main encounters that the players are going to run into. And I wanted each of them to sort of have like a different bent to it. I wanted them to not just have different tactics, but the players have to sort of think differently about each one rather than just fighting. So the first one with these Hezru, this is more of a fight encounter. But what the Hezru do is, the first thing they try to do is summon Tenari, these like other Hezru or Dretch demons, just like fill the room with sort of smaller minions or at least one equivalent to their own to try and outnumber the players. So it quickly becomes this big like mob battle where the Hezrus are the main foe, and then they summon like little dretches to also contribute to the chaos. And the Hezru also have a lot of crazy spell-like abilities that they can just do at will, including teleporting in gaseous form, which I love throwing my players up against those because they're annoying. You know, you can't hit that thing if it's in its gaseous form, and then it'll fly off to the other side of the room or whatever, wherever. So a big sort of ziggurat-style arena fight against these Hezru demons. And the funny thing is that the lore on the background on these Hezru, the players never find out what it is, but basically they were just abandoned there by their previous master. They're sort of left in the ziggurat area and just never given any other instructions on what to do. So they're like sort of hostile, but they have no clear direction as to where to go. They move around on this level, but they never really escape. And so as soon as there's actually some action here, they jump on it. Quite literally, because they're toad demons. Off the ziggurat are two passageways that lead off on opposite sides of the room. And both of these loop back around to the entrance to the god trap. So no matter which way the players went, they would eventually wind up at the entrance to the god trap, depending on, you know, how their encounters go. But in this case, they hang a right, they head off down one passageway, and the first thing they find is a statue of a serene-looking wizard. And unbeknownst to them, when they first see it, the wizard is Zagig, who was a wizard.
Oh, shit! The guy.
The guy. Basically, like, the creator of the God Trap. And
Gary Gygax's name all messed up.
Zagig. But it's not, though. It's not. Maybe in the pronunciation, it's spelt in the module as Z-A-G-I-G, but I could absolutely see it being X-A-G-Y-G, I guess, for Gygax, spelt backwards. You know, that's probably what it should be. I'm actually kind of annoyed that now that I realize this, that they didn't spell it that way in this module. Come on, guys.
Yeah, here we go. Okay, Zagig, formerly known as Zagig Urangirn, is the god of humor, eccentricity, occult lore, and unpredictability. His symbol is the Rune of Insanity. When Gary Gygax first created the dungeons underneath Castle Greyhawk in 1972, the complex labyrinth encompassed 13 levels filled with devious traps, secret passageways, hungry monsters, and glittering treasure. For anyone who made it to the bottom level alive, the insane architect of the dungeons, Zagig, awaited them. Zagig is a reverse homophone of Gygax, and was Gygax's inside joke that the person who designed this crazy purposeless place, himself, must be insane. In later material, Gygax expanded Zagig's name to Zagig Urangirn, a reverse homophone of his full name, Ernest Gary Gygax. Only three players ever made it to the bottom level and met Zagig, all of them during solo adventures. Rob Kunst playing Robilar, Gygax's son Ernie playing Tenser, and Rob's brother Terry playing Tarek. Their reward was that Zagig instantly teleported them to the far side of the world on a giant slide, where they each faced a long solo trek back to the city of Greyhawk.
Oh my god. That is some classic D&D nonsense right there. But
that's some classic Gygax shit.
Yeah, but you know what? That actually makes a lot of sense. It's a reverse homophone. So, of course, you know, Gygax spelt backwards would be Zagig, and then they just they spelled it phonetically instead. So, yes, Zagig, the Gary Gygax mad architect, there is a statue of him here, and Akona, the wizard.
So it wasn't him. It was just a statue.
It was just a statue.
I was all freaking out. I thought the guy himself was like, whoa.
In the original module.
It was another one of these things where, you know, Yuz himself, you know?
Right. No, in the original module, Zagig is there, and they do include him. But I didn't, you know, it's like the players are about to perform this insane ritual to try and summon Yuz and trap him in the God Trap. They're about to get into some big fights. So I was like, you know what? I'm gonna leave Zagig out of this one. But it's entirely possible.
It's,
you know,
it's
maybe
too bad
will...
you didn't. It's too bad you didn't replace him with the dungeon's new lord, Ligam.
oh boy. Nope. None of that.
Ligam Etouf.
Ligam Etouf. I actually. Again, not to go off on too much of a tangent here, but when I was in high school, I along with it was four of my friends, we created a comedy newsletter called the Uniceptor, where we would print it off once a month and just like pass it around the school, and it was filled with like. It was like The Onion, but just for our school, basically. We'd make fun of, you know, the recent spring variety show performances. Be like, wow, I had no idea so many people could tap dance and things like that. But all of our pseudonyms that we wrote under were our last names spelt backwards. So I was Etouf. And then at the end of the year, one of the guys who worked on the Uniceptor was on the yearbook committee, and so he managed to get it that we dedicated a page to all of us confessing that we were the authors of the Uniceptor, and then the confession ends with us saying, but don't worry, we got, you know, five other guys to take over for us, and it was all our first names spelled backwards.
Nice. I now have something that we need to include in the show notes, so one second.
Okay. I wish that the Uniceptor existed in digital form. I'd include some of our issues. But no, it does not.
So you see, when I was in high school, one time I managed to, you know, you ever get, you know, it's like you're supposed to get your yearbook photo. Everybody has like the photo day, but then if you miss the photo day, they do like a few extra ones.
Right.
So I missed the first photo day, so I got one of those extra ones. And I was like, wonder if I can pull a little pranky prank here. So, right, like I sat for the picture, and then as soon as, like, the guy got behind the camera, basically, to like take the picture, you know, I was like doing the smile like I was supposed to, and then as soon as he took the picture, I like changed my face into like a wacky ass grimace. So now I'm gonna include that in our show notes because it's one of my greatest achievements.
That oh, amazing.
This was the picture of me that got into the yearbook for my year. I'm also wearing a baseball tee that says Submariners Eat Their Dead, but
that's great.
It only says Submariners on it.
That's great. Oh man, I gotta blank out your name there, or otherwise people might learn some.
Is it visible?
Yeah, just
oh
the,
shit! It says enough of it is visible. Yeah,
enough Damn. Of it is visible. Don't want to dox you, Tom.
Oh geez, well. That's a great picture.
That's pretty good. Anyway, so the statue of Zagig provides an opportunity for Akona to fill in the players a bit on Zagig and saying like he was the mad architect of these dungeons and the creator of the god trap. And he would use carefully placed magic objects like this statue around the dungeons to aid him in his rituals. And so the statue has the rune on the statue's head, like in the middle of its forehead. And all I told the players was what I just said, you know, Akona saying, like, he placed these statues around to help him with his rituals. But any player who touched the rune would gain a +2 bonus on intelligence-based checks for the next 24 hours. So, like, a little buff if anybody dares to go for it. They pass through a small corridor and they arrive in what is basically a chapel. And this is another one of those chapels that looks like it bears a lot of similarities to the one where from the adventure where they interrupted the cult sacrifice. So there is like a black marble altar, and the whole place is decorated with sort of demonic features. Macabre ornaments hanging from iron chains and stone pillars and, you know, bones incorporated into the decoration. And there's a dais, the altar, and on the altar there is a woman tied up and standing, not even standing, like hanging onto the ceiling above her is this grotesque creature. Hang on, what's he called? He is a blaspheme. A blaspheme demon.
Ooh, that's a cool name.
Yeah, and they're sort of like, they have a almost like a zombie-like appearance, but they're quite spry. They're actually almost like a Frankenstein monster. Like they're sort of a bunch of things stitched together, but
it's like a demonic flesh golem.
Yeah, kind of like a demonic flesh golem. But unbeknownst to the players, the woman strapped to the altar is in fact a succubus. And this whole thing is
it's a trap.
Yeah, it's actually a trap. And so, and it's one that they fall right into because they are naturally, like, they're a pretty good party, especially Maeve. And so right away they're like, okay, we got to save her. And we have to attack this guy. And everything that this woman says sort of reinforces that. She, you know, cries out and says, help me, and, you know, save me from this monster. And But really what she does is, as soon as Eric runs over to free her, and as soon as he does, she casts Dominate on him and implants the suggestion that he should defend her and direct his allies' attention to the blaspheme. And so that's what happened. Eric, you know, frees her and says, you guys get that creature, that monstrous undead menace. And then and he is sort of sinking more and more into her control. Maeve is able to dispatch with the blaspheme very easily, being a paladin and fighting like an undead creature, but taking this succubus with them will, of course, later cause some trouble. Her name is Livashti, so Livashti will come into play, but for now she's sort of hanging back and acting sort of like a mole within their party to later sabotage their plans. And this is one of those cases where, like, the tactics that she uses are what's included in the module, saying, like, make sure to dominate the player that frees her, direct attention away from her, and they just, like, fell for it hook, line, and sinker. And this is one of those cases where I was doing that thing, I think we've talked about it before, but, like, trying to keep what was happening sort of overall a secret from the other players, but working with Steve, who played Eric. He's always game for, you know, a little bit of subterfuge like this. So I had a note pre-written, and then at an opportune time when people were, like, refreshing drinks and stuff, I'd slip it to him and be like, okay, so here's what's going on, and I just need you to play like you are, you know, act outwardly like you are defending her, but know that you are in fact in her thrall. Yeah. That is a great photo, Tom. It really is.
I was just editing it, so my, you know, none of my info was coming up.
So the players defeat the blaspheme, and they've got this, who they think.
I feel like nobody would be able to beat a blaspheme better than a paladin. Maybe, yeah, a cleric.
It's exactly that. And, you know, it's entirely possible that I was ready for the possibility that Maeve would free the woman and Eric would go after the blaspheme instead, which could have played out very differently, because the
Maeve could probably detect what was going on.
Exactly. And also the succubus is weak against divine spells, weak against divine magic overall. It could have gone a bit differently there, but no, it sort of paid off the exact way that the module suggested it should pay off. They pass through another chamber with Livashti in tow, passing through a laboratory that is filled with sort of unfinished research, and they go through all of these papers and they start finding clues as to how to operate the god trap, because this chamber is where Zagig performed his research and made preparations required to trap deities using the god trap, however long ago it was.
And little did we know, he was just trapping his deities so he could use them in future campaigns.
I mean, basically, yeah.
About the campaign Sass Tam must die. What about Zagig must die?
That'd be it.
Then it'll turn out he's already dead.
It'd be a pretty wicked one to run.
That there's a terrible order called the Wizards of the Coast that's perpetuating his terrible machinations.
Man, you know, like, I love that. I love that idea. And I really love, because it's like Wizards of the Coast is just asking for you to do that, right? They just want you to use, they're called the Wizards of the Coast. It's like the perfect name for an evil faction.
Man, you could even, like, start off with the villains being, like, the Temerian Security Regiment or something,
like
TSR, and then it turns out that the real villain, Zagig, was in fact ousted from the TSR before his wildest ideas.
I really like this idea, doing like a meta campaign for D&D.
Also, I did a bit of like minor research in the background after mentioning that thing about Gygax and his cocaine use, and apparently like one of the theorized reasons that TSR did oust Gygax was because he was such a wild party man, giving him a bad name.
Oh, wow.
Apparently he was always throwing sexy pool parties at his Hollywood estate doing cocaine, and also supposedly he would be driven around by the supermodels he was sleeping with because he himself never learned to drive.
Oh my god. The
guy which is literally, it's the most like D&D nerd thing ever, really, is to not have your own driver's license but then have other people drive you around. That's what your players are.
Yeah, he was living that nerd dream. He's the, oh my god, the Wolf of Wizards of the Coast. I'd watch that. I would absolutely watch that. Where is our Gary Gygax biopic? I want it.
I mean, the FBI had a file on him, so.
And the Satanic Pan. We really need that. Damn it. Why isn't there a Gary Gygax story?
There's definitely great like biographies about him that you can get. I just wonder, you know, maybe someone has optioned them. Who knows?
Well, it's really funny because the other night I watched the movie Pirates of the Silicon Valley, which is like a fictionalized docudrama biopic about Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, both sort of founding Apple and Microsoft around the same time and being friends, but also being competitors and like stealing technology from Xerox or traveling to, you know, Japan and stealing technology there to build their own computer empires. And it is heavily fictionalized, but also I thought it was pretty fun and also interesting to watch now because the movie was made in 1999. So, of course, so much has happened since then with those stories. But while I was, you know, thinking back on it now, I'm like, oh, man, I'd totally watch like a D&D themed movie like this, a D&D themed docudrama.
Man, I just want to say, when we get to see someone win Best Actor for portraying Gary Gygax,
who would play him? That's the question.
Man, so I almost God, yeah, that is tough. I kind of, so the first name that came to mind was Brian Cox, guy from Succession.
Yeah, yeah. I was gonna say Paul Giamatti.
That's a good one. Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be a great turn for Paul Giamatti, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. Ah, geez, I gotta roll a d20, man. Get it together, PG.
Hey, I double booked and I'm supposed to go to two orgies in LA at once. Do you mind driving me to one, but then after I finish, you drive me to the other one? Miss Finland?
Man, I'm so enamored with the idea of like Gary Gygax snorting a big line of cocaine off a supermodel's butt and being like, all right, let's all play some D&D. Like trying to get all of these hotties interested in playing Dungeons and Dragons while he's on a cocaine binge.
I mean, it's literally part of the appeal of the whole D&D with porn stars project, as it had originally existed. But I also want to say that like, just the idea of I think it would be so fascinating to have just one of the major characters be this woman who is a supermodel that Gary Gygax is sleeping with, who is also his driver.
Wake up. I gotta go to the store. He like makes her wake up. She's all hungover, and then she drives him to the 7-Eleven so he could get Mountain Dew.
Yeah.
So the final encounter that I'll describe on this level.
Supermodel driving Gary Gygax to Gen Con.
Oh my god. You know, maybe at some point we've got to just dedicate an episode of this show to workshopping this idea, this movie idea. Get it all down and recorded in case somebody else makes it first. The players arrive at an area called The Approach. And there is an archway that is a portal to the God Trap. The thing about the God Trap is that you don't just like walk through a hallway. You got to teleport into the middle of the chamber. And so there is, you know, this archway made of stone, and there's swirling mist filling the arch, glowing with like muted blue light. And then on either side of it are two 15-foot tall crystalline statues of human warriors. And sure enough, those statues are diamond golems. And this is another big fight here where, because they are golems, they're constructs, and they are immune to criticals, but also immune to magic, and they have resistance to many other spell-like abilities. So this was like, this was the big fight of this session. I mean, how do I even describe it? Like, they're fighting these two giant diamond golems. Maybe a good way to sort of describe what they're going up against here is, here's the list of immunities. Immune to ability damage, ability drain, critical hits, death effects, death from massive damage, disease, energy drain, exhaustion, fatigue, mind affecting spells and abilities like charms, magic immunity, necromancy effect, non-lethal damage, paralysis, poison, sleep, stunning, and any effect that requires a fortitude save. It's immune to all of that. And really, the one thing that they're vulnerable to is a monk's chi strike ability, but there was no monk in the party.
Wow. Okay.
And then any creature struck by a diamond golem is affected by a targeted dispel magic effect as well. So these things are like anti-magic fighters. Big guardians leading to the God Trap. It would make sense that there'd be two big guardians here. And what was interesting about this is, at this point in the campaign, Stash had obtained a pass-through stone spell. So it was around this time that Stash had gotten a spell that allows her to pass through stone. And I didn't realize it during this encounter, but it'll come into play in the next session when they actually get into the God Trap. But the player who played Stash, Cecily, was developing this idea. She had it in her head, this idea where if she could use pass through stone to get inside a stone golem, maybe she'd be able to control the stone golem, which of course you can't do.
Hey, you've mentioned this. I remember
that's right.
This is another one that's come up on the podcast before.
That's right. So you can't do it, but this is where the idea started to form in her head. And so during this encounter, she asks, like, I have a pass-through stone spell. Can I get inside one of these things? And I went, no, they're made of diamond. And that is where it dropped off. But it will come back into play. So after a lengthy fight with these two diamond golems that really put everybody on the back foot, they managed to... in fact, in my notes, I even have it. They didn't kill both of them. They killed one, and then they just all ran through the portal to get the hell out of there. And so next session will begin with them entering the chamber of the God Trap.
Man, all that. And I don't.
And all that.
I sort of lost track of what we're doing.
All that and a bag of jalapeno Fritos hoops.
Dangus Bank called me while I was fucking trying to do this. The bank that I already, pretty sure I said on the thing I dealt with, happened 2 weeks ago. And this guy calls me to go through all the stuff that I did 2 weeks ago, like I haven't done it already.
God.
It's like, dude, you're two weeks late. And also, I can barely understand you. And also, everything you're saying, you're clearly reading off of sheet of paper. It doesn't include any like critical security information. And also, the only reason he was calling me was so that at the end of all that droning, he could get me to say, yes, I understand, which I could have clicked on a button.
I love
Jesus
I love
Christ.
That this saga is being included as like a background plot in our podcast.
I mean, I might as well give this shout. Do not bank with either Simply Financial or CIBC, because Simply Financial is just a part of CIBC that'll keep fucking transferring you to CIBC anytime you have a problem with them.
I'm glad to say I don't bank with either of them.
So there you go.
So we've gone a little bit long, and I've been hogging the tavern lately, and I was just going to read off another monster recipe, but I really want to hear about your tavern pick before we close off this episode.
Well, and this one's a pretty easy one for me, because it's not so much something I found so much as it's stuff that I've created based on a previous tavern pick that I thought I'd share for people who
are
exciting. Because I ran a little game of Fleshscape while I was in Halifax.
So cool.
My friends. Now, Fleshscape, I will say, is sort of designed to be a very nomadic, tribal... It's like a setting without much defined civilization beyond the tribes. And I kind of broke that rule for Tom Lando's Fleshscape. You know, it's funny. I definitely, one of these days, I'm going to have to bring Monty Cook's World of Darkness to the tavern. Because White Wolf had the legendary game creator Monty Cook make his own take on World of Darkness and release it as a single book thing. So similar to how Monty Cook's version of World of Darkness was perhaps much more like apocalyptic than the World of Darkness that we knew at the time. Tom Lando's Fleshscape, it has a little bit more civilization to it. But let me hit you with what I got. In the north, you got the Gutlands. The Gutlands, where there are sprawling hair farms tended to by the gore spittle blood goblins.
I love those.
Now, the hair farms, they're good for growing the hair, which you use to make your hair ropes, which is a quality item that is provided in the main game. But the real money in hair farms is in the meat lice. Pig-like lice that live in among the hair of the hair farms, the hair stalks. You know, it's like in a cornfield, but instead you got a hair field. And then there's all these piggy little meat lice, all these meaty little meat lice crawling around in the hair.
This is awesome.
So you can harm
and disgusting.
You can farm the meat lice to have delicious pork. But if there's also meat fleas in the hair farms, but that's more like hunting rabbits. A meat flea has a good jump to it, and you don't get as much meat out of it. So it's better to, you know, farm the meat lice. Now, the Gutlands, occupied by the gore spittle blood goblins and their farming industry, they have many fine items like tendon nets and harpoons. Harpoons made by like a tooth on a stick that you then, like a bone that you then tie some tendon around, and so you've got a harpoon with a line on it. They got, of course, quality skin leather, and then they got sticky cane, which is a strange, it's like sugar cane. It's like, you know, these little, almost like bamboo shoots that you find growing, but, you know, if you stimulate them by rubbing them up and down, the end of the cane will produce a sweet, sticky liquid, fluid. And so you can use that. It's like renewable sugar cane. And then in the Gutlands, you've also got the Blood Bog, which is the original home of the gore spittle blood goblins. And near that, they have the Rotting Garden, where there's a garden of strange decomposing vegetation and fruits and whatnot that they use for certain alchemical reagents and whatnot. But the greatest innovation of the gore spittle blood goblins in recent years has been the creation of gall cannons and fleshlock muskets and pistols. So the way these work is the Blood Bog produces a lot of like noxious gas from within its murky depths. And the blood goblins, the Gorspittle blood goblins of the blood bog, have they've taken on a sort of craft, which is, when you have like a bubble maker, like one of those little things you dip in the fluid and you blow and the bubble comes out?
Bubble wand. Bubble used wand. By the Yabiyar of Rifts.
Yeah. So the Gorspittle blood goblins, they craft tiny little instruments that are like bubble wands made of little bones that are tied together and whatnot. And then they use these, they dip them into the blood bog and then slowly draw them out. And they draw out a bubble of the fumes rising from the bog, and then they let it sort of blob on the end of the wand, you know. And then you quickly have to pinch the bubble shut because it's very sort of thick, viscous slime. And then they dip it in a large quantity of, like, cooling congealed fat that they have stored up, and the fat congeals and solidifies around the little gas bubble, and then that becomes a gas fat pod, which is basically like a round for a fleshlock musket or pistol. And then you put the little gas fat pod into like where the cartridge would go. You put your bullet into the thing, and then the hammer has a little, like, fuse on it, which you light so that when the hammer pierces the gas fat pod, it explodes with, fiery explosive energy, which then launches out either a series of projectiles from a fleshlock musket or from a fleshlock pistol. And the Gaul cannon is just, like, the cannon-sized version of this.
This is, like, gloriously disgusting. I'm impressed.
So, south of the Gutlands is the realm of Synapse, where the kingdom of Fuel Marrow reigns. Ruled by King Medallon, the kingdom of Fuel Marrow is rich from their royal ossuary, a huge treasury of all the finest bones gathered by the kingdom's Bonejack Guild. They also boast the institution of the Scar Reader's Library, which educates the exclusively literate scar readers in the art of reading the scars upon the flesh of the texts of the kingdom. The Bonejack Guild occupies the Rattling Canopy, a huge forest of bones that blocks out any light above. And with the help of the Bonejack Guild's finest architects and innovators, the kingdom of Fuel Marrow now boasts an incredible remarkable piece of artillery known as the Skeletal Array. And this is actually inspired by a legendary kind of, not legendary because it was real, but like a very well-known, there was a movie about it called like Heavenly Weapon or something. Basically, it was in old Korea. There was a whole, you know, typical situation. You've got invaders coming, too many invaders to drive back. You know, how does the smaller force win? And some brilliant inventor basically created an artillery piece which could launch like hundreds of arrows per second. It was basically like, imagine, it was kind of like, imagine like a SAMS, you know, those surface to air missile turrets. Imagine like a blocky thing like that, but just made of like sticks and ropes and like levers and pulleys and stuff. And then you, in each like sort of missile slot, you would feed in a bundle of arrows that were all tethered together that would then all shoot and basically come out as like a whole volley of arrows that would just rain down on enemy ships.
Nice.
And so they had this thing that people could just keep feeding arrows in, and it would just rain arrows on the coast
forever.
Sounds
like one of those siege weapons, the porcupine.
Yeah. And so, inspired by that, I came up with the Kingdom of Fuelmeryl's skeletal array, which uses bundles of digit bolts, little fingers as the arrows. And they use this to protect both their kingdom, their clear blood reservoir, and the realm of Synapse borders right onto Belly Bay. And so basically you've got Belly Bay in the south, then in the to the north of Belly Bay, you've got the Kingdom of Fuelmeryl, and then beyond them, you've got the Gutlands. And the Kingdom of Fuelmeryl protects the Gutlands, which are sort of like their breadbasket, from raiders that come across Belly Bay in the form of the Bone Boys Raider Tribe, who come from the Nails, a series of gigantic finger and toenails that come out like ridges. Whoa. On the southern coast of Belly Bay. And their flagship is Naglfar, a ship made out of giant toenails and fingernails, which is a reference to the Norse mythology ship Naglfar, which is made out of the toenails and fingernails of the dead, and which is claimed to at Ragnarok. Basically, a whole bunch of monsters are gonna sail and fuck shit up with Naglfar. That is a ship made of all of our discarded toenails and fingernails.
This is great. Were you like working on this on the plane ride there?
Man, you called it. This is literally what I did on the plane ride there. So basically the deal with the Gutlands and the Kingdom of Fuelmeryl is that the Kingdom of Fuelmeryl holds back the raiders of Belly Bay. And then beyond that kingdom, the Gutlands are protected, and therefore the Gorespittle blood goblins can continue to supply the Kingdom of Fuelmeryl with their goods. So there's a good alliance between the Gorespittle Blood Goblins and the Kingdom of Fuelmeryl against raiders such as the Bone Boys Raider Tribe of the South. But the Bone Boys don't think that they don't have some special technology of their own. You see, they engage in the dangerous practice of using weapons such as bile throwers and fire bladders, which are big. Basically, they get these big bladders that are full of like caustic fluid or flammable gas, and then they make a nozzle from it and then turn it into like a very dangerous, like kind of flamethrower or acid thrower, basically. And also, from the depths of Belly Bay, their divers collect the volatile bile crystals that can be used as an explosive substance. All of this, and even then, in the wilderness to the north east, is the mountain range known as the Underbite, which is footed by the calloused steppes and boasts the greatest peak of Mount Erythmia, where it is said that a fearsome beast, possibly even one of the old great dragons, lurks, known as the Fleshalisk, creature that can freeze you into pure flesh and blood. And around a huge rounded mount known as the Club, people watch for a legendary and hated hermit molder known as Callous Wolf, who some believe to be related and perhaps in league with the Fleshalisk. And that's what I got for Tom Lando's Fleshscape so far.
That is super cool, man. You should write an expansion on it. Write your own little module for it, because I think that's a really...
We just hit up Emmanuel Dumaidit and tell him to check out this episode.
Yeah, that too.
I don't want to have to write shit down.
Well, but you've clearly already written most of it down. Or is this all of off the top of your head?
I mean, I'll tell you what I got written down. It says, Gutlands, Hair Farms, Gorespittle Blood Goblins, Meat Lice, Tendon Nets and Harpoons, Skin Leather, Sticky Cane, The Blood Bog. And I got little, like, I did a little doodle of what it looks like to have, like, oh man, now I'm going to have to include this picture in the thing. So now I'm going to just picture it. But you know, I should be able to put literally all of my notes and doodles for this all in one picture.
Well, that is the brilliance of one of the many brilliant touches to Fleshscape. I do love the small scale document that provides everything you need to create a big wild world like the one you did. Super cool, man. I really like this stuff. A lot of really great ideas.
Yeah, I'm just trying to line up this picture now.
I like that we're getting in real time.
Anyways, point is, this was episode 81. If you want to get in touch with us, comparing campaigns, see when we post new episodes, and contact us, maybe read me a bunch of useless information off a piece of paper that I could have used maybe 2 weeks beforehand. If you want to hit me with that, check us out on Facebook, comparing campaign on Facebook. Or if you want to see our supplemental materials, aka our show notes, links to pictures of my doodles and my notes, and you can figure out what the heck we were talking about when we said this is my Milwaukee, all that stuff, you just check us out on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com. Anything else?
Level up your Fleshscape.
Not me.